You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Phil, for those who haven't come across you online, tell our listeners who you are and give us a snapshot of kind of what we're talking about in general today.
My name's Philip Baker, PharmD. I'm a pharmacist. I graduated from the University of Tennessee in 2005. Seeing kind of the retail world and the hospital world. My story is that in 2013, I was really pleased with how my life had turned out. Felt burdened to know if this is the plan that the Lord had for me. After feeling like I was called, started a nonprofit dedicated to medication management. I formed the nonprofit, decided to open an on-site pharmacy and said, we're not going to accept insurance. We're going to be 100% transparent. If the drugs are free, we're going to give them away for free. If we can't get something for free, we're going to sell it at cost, at our cost with no markup. And we're going to live and die on our membership fees. When we got to 1,000 patients, it was September of 2017 when we actually pulled this off. We synchronized all 1,000 patients, all of their prescriptions, so they're all due on the same day 4 times a year. So the whole pharmacy operates on a set schedule, set 12-week schedule that resets with each quarter, what we call the batch fill.
Every patient is on that one date. It's not like your floating date. It's all on that one date 4 times a year.
Exactly. It changes the pharmacy's operational model to align with these 4 set chip dates. And so we just did a batch. We do a batch in January. All of our patients, all of their refills were due in their hands by February 1st.
You've got the time then each quarter to make sure you're getting the right amount of medicine for that, right?
It fundamentally shifts the pharmacy in a way that actually aligns the incentives of the pharmacy with the incentives of the patient. So that sounds like highfalutin, but what that means is we don't fill anything unless it has to be filled. We're trying to do as few fills as possible. We make the same membership fee if they do 6 fills in a month or if they do 1. So we want to be as efficient as we possibly can. And so we have the batch fill. And then if there's any new medications or changes that get started between set ship dates, then we only send enough medicine to last until the next ship date. We never do a 30-day fill. We always do an odd number. It may be 62 pills because that's going to last you until February 1st. And then everything is going to go out together again and be kept on the same schedule all the time.
You're not getting paid for the fill, you're getting paid the membership fee. The more efficient you can be, the better.
Which benefits the patient as well. You want them ideally, to, if you're doing your job well, they're going to take fewer prescriptions. They're going to get healthier. They're going to take fewer prescriptions. The incentives are aligned. We don't want to overfill anything. We want to give you exactly what you need when you need it and nothing more. And because we're not profiting off every single fill, we can focus on making sure we do a profile review every 30 days on every one of our patients, not like a computer generated one, like human eyes looking at the profile review. If we get a new prescription between ship dates, that stands out. Why are we getting this? What's going on here? And so it's enabled us to be hyper efficient. That process is, I call it group synchronization, really creative in that, but it's group synchronization of prescriptions. And we've applied for a method patent on that. We've made it work with several different pharmacy systems, so it's not specific to QS1 or Pioneer or any specific system. We can teach people how to do it. And I do believe that fundamentally, by synchronizing the entire group, you get several blue ocean changes that create real opportunities. For one, you shift the business model from an inventory business model where you got to have all these drugs on the shelves because you never know who's going to walk in with what, to a JIT model. So we carry about a $10,000 inventory in a pharmacy that would normally have like a $2 million inventory. We're able, you know, because we know it needs to be filled on this date. We know what we're filling. We can order everything in one huge order and get bigger discounts than you might get without the bulk ordering. But we can also go a step further and order precision, or I got to call precision ordering. So if I know, and I do know that I gave my patient 90 pills on February 1st, February, March, April, they should run out of that medicine by March 31st. So if it expires in June, I don't care. I know I'm safe. I'm within that expiration. So if they're synced, then you can purchase short dated stuff up in bulk as well. All of this serves to drive the prices below average market, even average market pharmacy wholesale cost.
you're getting drugs either from the manufacturer or even some people that have unopened bottles and so on. And so that expiration date's very important.
We accept donated meds directly from manufacturers, but we generally get, we're tied into every disaster relief organization in the country that provides prescription meds to charity pharmacies and safety net clinics and all those sorts of things. So there's a handful of programs that did exist that allowed reclamation from hospitals and nursing homes, but there weren't any that allowed individual patients or family members to make a donation. And so Tennessee didn't really have any laws on the books. And when we went with the legislators to get the law changed, we made sure that we had it written so that we could accept from any individual person anywhere in the country. So we can literally accept donations from any individual anywhere in the country. They have to be unopened, unexpired. They have to be in absolutely pristine condition, essentially. They're in their, you know, the manufacturer's original packaging with the foil seal. We are not taking back the amber vial. It has got to be in blister packaging. Luckily, these specialty meds are so valuable that they're usually in kind of fancy packaging. But so that happened. We couldn't legally accept the meds, seeing really, you know, $30,000, $45,000 meds coming in. I worked with a couple of legislators in Tennessee for 2 years to get a bill passed so that we could create a program. We made sure that a program allowed us to accept donated meds from any individual anywhere in the country. Those meds have to go first to uninsured, low-income uninsured patients in Tennessee. If there's not a low-income uninsured patient in Tennessee that's available when we have the med, then it can go to other states, other healthcare facilities in other states. And so what we did was we really started officially in March of this year, like right before COVID hit. We created a campaign that allows anybody to donate their unused, unopened oral chemotherapies. And we did specifically narrow it down to we're only accepting oral chemotherapies. I just simply can't afford to open up and say, I'll take anything anybody wants to send me. But we narrowed it down to oral chemotherapies, and we created a website called flipyourscript.com, and it shows how you can text a picture of it. And if it's something we can legally accept, then we text that person a donation form and a FedEx link so that we cover the shipping. It doesn't cost them anything. They fill out the form, they throw it in a box and have FedEx pick it up, and it's on our dime. And so that kicked off in March of this year. And from March to the end of the year, we brought in upwards of $3 million worth of oral chemotherapies, 300 different, 30, you know, they're usually in a 30-day packaging. So 330, let's call them 30-day supplies. We didn't start connecting those with uninsured patients immediately because I didn't know what I was going to get. So it was pretty late in the year when we started matching meds with patients.
When you said that was a parameters of having to use it, my first thought was, well, of course you'll find somebody because you have people in need. But I imagine with the certain cancer medicines, you might not have somebody that needs that medicine, right?
Especially for us, like we're just starting out. So where we're at now, like 9-10 months in, we have a handful of cancer centers and oncologists that love us and they're finding all their patients in it. But starting out, man, it was like, hey, we've got this stuff. Just put the word out. The program's called Remedy Chain, and we do plan to expand it this year to beyond specialty meds to do any brand name drug. But it's gotten so much attention that people don't realize that it was our side gig. It was this other thing that we were going to do so that we didn't have to, you know, tell people to throw these meds away. But all that to say that we did match meds with 16 patients last year. We've got three or four active patients. We've got one patient we've been providing chemo to for 5 months now. And we got a really active program. The word's kind of getting out. We're the medications in November. We got $345,000 worth of medication donations in a single month. It was our best month ever. And our donations are just hockey sticking. So
from individuals,
50% from individuals and family members, but 50%. And I really want to emphasize this, have come from pharmacists who care, who are in a cancer center somewhere and they're seeing meds get thrown away, or they have people bring them back stuff like happened at my pharmacy. And even though they're not legally supposed to accept it, they throw it in a drawer. I've been meeting those people and they've been sending me millions of dollars worth of meds, literally.
someone might bring it back. And the typical pharmacist, it might have been a wife of a husband who died. And they say, he's got all this cancer medicine. And the pharmacists know they can't do anything with it, but they might not want to throw it away in front of the spouse or something. But these pharmacists then are able to flip the script to look in your program and do it, right?
With our program, it actually serves a pain point because people do take a lot back to the clinic. And not in all states. Some states do allow the physicians to do a little bit if they redispense it right back out of there. But for most part, yeah, we're the solution. They don't even – the clinic, we made sure it's no work for the nurse in the clinic. All they have to do is say, go to flipyourscript.com, or they can text us. We try to do everything over text message. We designed the whole platform to really run over text message. They text us. We send them a form that they open. They take a picture of the med. It's all, you know, highly automated. And the cancer center doesn't have to register that they touched it, or they don't have to do anything at all. So, yeah, like most of our, like 50%, I can't say most, 50% have come from individual family members. Like we expected, but I've been pleasantly surprised that I'm hitting on these what I call super donors, which are pharmacists and cancer centers in Louisville, Kentucky. And we've got one in Wyoming. We've got some folks in California that don't get anybody in trouble, but just that people brought stuff back and they threw it in a box because they didn't have the heart to flush it.
Do those pharmacists have to get their fingerprints at all on it? And I'm not saying it's, I'm just kind of thinking like, let's say a pharmacist was skeptical, but Mrs. Smith brought something back. Can they send it without sending a bunch of pharmacy information?
They have the option. So they, when they fill out the donation form, if they have Mrs. Smith's info, we want that info. But if they don't, we can accept a donation from any individual or any healthcare provider. If it's a healthcare provider like a pharmacist, then they have to write in what date they received the med and how they got it. And so either way, they can make the donation. If a pharmacist makes a donation in that way, there is no record. The only record is a picture of their signature. So what we have to report to the state is that they signed the form. We don't have to report the pharmacist's name and address and all this other stuff. There's nothing to worry about there. Additionally, the program is 100% voluntary and all liability for all participants in the program has been waived. So there shouldn't be anything to be concerned about.
When I was at Purdue years ago, we had this mission called Matthew 25, you know, in the Bible where it talks about feeding the poor and visiting the prison and stuff like that. But they would just take back like... They would just take like open vial bottles and stuff from people. Hey, Phil, I got to ask this question before we go on. You are an air traffic controller. When?
Straight out of high school.
Out of high school?
Yeah, I left for the Marine Corps the day after I graduated high school.
Why? Was that a ROTC kind of thing or did you just decide to go?
It was a reservist thing, but because I wanted to do air traffic control, I ended up being on active duty for quite some time. And so I signed up. I was in the delayed entry program the summer before my senior year. I did like a month-long thing. And then once a month during my senior year, I drilled with the Marines in Millington near where I live. And then the day after I graduated high school, I was on a bus headed to Parris Island.
How long after that did you do air traffic? When did that start then?
Man, I never got to do it. So I went to, you go to basic training, and then you go to combat training, and then you go to your school, air traffic control school. I want to say, it's been 20 years, I want to say it was about a year long, probably 9 to 12 months long, and then certifications follow the school, and they take some time too. I was supposed to be a reservist and drill once a month here in Memphis where I live, and while I was in the course of going to those schools and everything, they moved my Marine Corps unit to Dallas. So that when I got out of the reserves and was ready to finally be a reservist, they moved my unit and I couldn't be a reservist. I ended up going on the inactive reserves. So I did all the school and the certification, but I never really got to.
Oh, so you trained for it all, but you didn't get to go live. All right. So here's a question I have. All these pharmacists are, we all have horror stories of working in the chains and being bombarded and not getting away for lunch and all this stuff. And I've always said to myself, how does that compare to an air traffic controller? Because you hear about like air traffic controllers being like, well, you know, you got people's lives in your line and these planes might crash and all that kind of stuff. If you could line these two up, between a busy pharmacy with the upper management just coming down and just, you know, all the stuff that goes along with that versus an air traffic controller. Is it close? Is any one of them in the lead of being a terrible pressure job or what?
If you can. Okay. So I've never been asked that before. It's a great question. So I would have to relate it to being at a community chain pharmacy on a Friday evening when you've got a 2-hour wait and your counter is lined with prescriptions that haven't been entered yet, and you've got 30 people in line at the register angry and looking at you, which I've been there. Obviously, you come out of school and get slammed on a weekend. The pressure is the same. The pressure is the same. The stress is different. The situation is different. But keeping a cool head under pressure is, that's the name of the game, not letting it get to you. So having a bunch of plates in the air at the same time is, I tell you, there's the three things that come to mind are like that pharmacy description I gave you. When I was in high school, I worked at a Long John Silver's and I worked the drive-through, and that was one of the most stressful things I ever did as well.
Now we got Long John Silver's in the mix too. So out of the three then, which one out of those three jobs, and I know you didn't get a chance to go live with the air traffic, but I'm sure you saw a lot of it. Out of those three, which one is going to just frazzle someone?
Oh, definitely, man. You screw up their fish at Long John Silver's, they're going to be out for blood, at least in Memphis, where I'm from, North Memphis.
Seriously, which one?
Well, I tell you, I don't think, man, that's kind of the, I'm not very elegant, but I guess the point I'm trying to make is it's the same.
It's the same.
And that, yeah, the intensity level.
Gotcha.
You're focused. You don't want to make a mistake. Gotcha. But you also can't be too focused because you've got to see the bigger picture of what's going on. And there's no, it's kind of like I tell my kids, I've got, my oldest is 14. And we got all the way down to a baby. But she's starting on calculus and asked me, is it hard? And it's like, well, I tell them, anytime you're learning it, there's not different degrees of hard. If something's just hard, then it's hard, you know, and that's what I relate it to.
I've told people that it's like, let's say you had to get up and give a commencement speech or something like that. And then let's say some other time someone has to return something to Walmart, but they're not sure if there's going to be confrontation. You know, it's the same adrenaline inside the people. Mm-hmm. If you're a person that's going to get kind of nervous from that, you can't always look at the difference of the thing. It's just like, pressure sometimes is just pressure. This can hit you from all sides.
Yep.
My wife, she grew up on another side of town, and she always tells me how poor they were. And her example of poor, she said, we were so poor that my friends and I, after school, we would go to Long John Silver's, and they would give us
The crumbs.
they'd get the crumbs, you know, those little droplets of the batter. And they would eat those, and that was her big poor story. And I'm thinking, well, that's not so bad. If that's your definition of poor, then, you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
So, Phil, when you talked about finding God's path in your life, you weren't just throwing out the idea of going. You actually did a few mission trips. When was that in your field to Belize and Nicaragua?
Well, I didn't come to faith until I was pretty late in life. I think I was 35. And so that is, I really had hit rock bottom. And, that was the biggest turning point in my life, was coming to know Jesus Christ. When that happened for me, my life started looking really different. I'd been, I still am a very selfish, self-centered person. But I say that to say I'd never volunteered anywhere. I was 35 years old. I didn't do volunteer work. I didn't care about anybody but myself. So one of the first things I did was start volunteering at Le Bonheur to just go hold the babies.
At a hospital there?
Yeah, a children's hospital here in Memphis. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And simply, you just go and you just hold the sick babies because they need to be held as much as they can. Wow. And then that led to different volunteer opportunities. And through the church I had joined, I learned about, I saw a mission trip for Belize, and I had never even heard of the country of Belize. PharmD, truth, I'd never heard of it. I didn't know where it was. And I was like, wow, that's crazy. And so that intrigued me.
You were married at the time?
No, I wasn't.
You weren't married yet?
No, I actually, I met my wife on the airplane on the way to Belize on that mission trip.
No kidding.
Yeah, and we met. We were on that mission trip together for a week and fell in love, and we were engaged 6 weeks later and married just a few months after that.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I did do a trip with it wasn't a mission trip so much because it was a bunch of Jewish doctors and healthcare workers to Nicaragua that was, I'm dying to go back. It was just so phenomenal. We were up in the mountains in Nicaragua and helping patients that don't get out of the coffee fields, super young mothers, carried meds with us into the country. And just super, super fulfilling work. I've since gone on to have, my wife has had five babies. And we have baby number six on the way.
Oh, congratulations.
And so the mission trips aren't just happening right now as much as we would like. But we're both committed to a life of mission trips and ministry is what we hope to do and teach our kids.
When was it after the mission trip that you thought about the change in pharmacy when you were, you know, praying for direction and that kind of stuff? Was that because you had already been in pharmacy then for 10 years or so, right?
Yeah, I think so. No, five at that
point. Five.
Yeah.
Oh, because of the Marines and all that stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started a little later than everybody else.
Was it around that time that you're saying, all right, now I got to find out what I'm supposed to be doing with all this?
Yeah, I was, like I said, the director of pharmacy, it was a really comfortable job. It wasn't under rehab hospital. The patients are there for 2 weeks. You're not turning beds every 48 hours. You get to know them well. We did a lot of hip and knee replacements. And so it just wasn't like a high stressful, busy job. It was really comfortable. And I'd met my wife and we'd been married. It was probably 2 months after we got married. So a couple of years after the mission trip that I actually started the nonprofit.
Did you feel like you were bored, or did you think that you weren't hitting your full potential when you were kind of looking for more direction? What was the thought pattern of thinking that God might have different directions for you?
It wasn't so much boredom, but I'd come from a low, low to a super duper high, where I was literally just didn't really want to go on anymore. I just married the most beautiful woman I've ever met, and we've got a brand new baby son, and we live in a really nice neighborhood, and I work a job where I'd actually have to go to work 6 hours a day. It's not super stressful, and I'm 35 years old or 37, whatever I was then, and that's pretty much all I had ever wanted for myself. Is this, it wasn't boredom so much as like, was this just it then? Is this, you know, really, the Lord's has blessed me with everything that I could have thought for myself that I would have wanted. And so I thought, well, what does he want? And how come I've never asked him? Well, Lord, what would you have for me? What would you like me to do? I believe strongly that I met my wife because I prayed to meet my wife, to meet the woman that the Lord had set aside for me. And he answered that prayer better than I ever could have imagined. She's the most wonderful woman I've ever met. And so it was kind of the same thing. Well, wow, you did that for my marriage, Lord. What would you do for my job? What would you have me do? And so it wasn't boredom. It was just, I guess, seeking more fulfillment and just truly wanting to know that I was in his will. And saying, and that's the other thing too, because this Good Shepherd's 5 years old now. And as I mentioned earlier, like we've got basically five different companies. It's grown to this incredible project, but the Lord didn't say, here's a vision to go build this huge organization 5 years ago. He said, trust me, one step at a time, go start a pharmacy. We started the pharmacy when we won a grant for $25,000. It was all the money we had. I quit my job. We opened, we had free rent for the first year, but with 25 grand in the bank, I quit my job and no revenue. And we just started because the Lord said to get started. And so every year, every month, it's just, all right, Lord, what are we doing now? Where are our opportunities? Where can we have the biggest impact? When people bring you $30,000 drugs and you tell them they got to flush them down the toilet, that doesn't take a lot of thinking. Like, that's not right. That doesn't make sense. Let me fix that. We never really had any, we've never had a ton of money as a nonprofit, so we've had to be innovative. One of the first things that we did was we started a free pharmacy technician school. So I was getting tech students from Remington and Concord and, you know, all the usual places. And I was surprised to find out how much those students paid in tuition. It's just, an incredible amount. And so I decided I'm going to do it for free. They'll come in, they'll get 400 hours in the pharmacy, they'll get one-on-one with me, and I'll get them certified. I've done that. I've hired sharp high school students and taught them what they need to know. I've been doing it for years. And so we kicked that off. And since then, we've graduated 5 students who are now certified technicians and make $15 an hour or more. 2 work for us full time. The reclamation program, it's kind of like, if you look at your list of expenses as a pharmacy, your biggest one's going to be drugs. We have Remedy Chain to kind of help offset that. Then you've got labor. We have the technician school and the pharmacy schools. We get a lot of students from them. We offset those. And then shipping is another project, a whole nother company now that we've started that's doing prescription delivery using share ride drivers. But just going down that expense list and thinking, how do we make this better? Specifically, the question I ask myself is, how do I get, okay, so drugs, how do I get somebody to pay me to take their drugs? That was the thought that led to kind of to doing this whole thing. How do I actually get drugs and make money just bringing them in before I dispense them?
Yeah, I've always said I wanted to get into the excavating business, you know, because people pay you to, they pay you to take the dirt and then someone pays you to drop it off. You're bringing up the term the remedy chain, and I know that's the flow of the medicine, where it's been and so on.
So when we did the reclamation program, at the same time that was really firing up, I was reading, and because I'm a super nerd, I'm not really a technology guy, but I was interested in blockchain technology with all that was happening with Bitcoin and all this stuff. And not cryptocurrency, but blockchain technology is what specifically interested me.
Which they use it for electricity sharing, all kinds of stuff. People think of Bitcoin, but it goes all over the place, blockchain.
You digitize any asset at all. That intrigued me because now, this was a couple of years ago, but now it's well known that blockchain is really good for pharma. It's good for supply chain. It's because our data is standardized into NDC, lot number, expiration date, and with a serial number on the package, you can track anything. But early on, I realized we've got these high value meds. What if we, you know, track them on a blockchain? We could tokenize them. We could create a digital asset, a digital twin, if you will. We could do a lot of different interesting things. And that really was, I didn't realize how early on that was in the blockchain technology cycle. I got connected to a community of people in that domain that has been just the biggest blessing in my life. Some of the smartest people I've ever met that are really at the cutting edge of healthcare and technology. And that network, I recruited all the people, the best people to work with me on Remedy Chain. So the chemo meds get all the attention, as they should. They're very high, high dollar, expensive. We match them with patients. We're saving lives. They're time critical. They're wonderful. But what's not spoken about that is even more valuable are the medications that aren't able to be recycled. So the data on prescription waste doesn't get captured anywhere in the ecosystem. There's no private entity or government agency that is responsible for tracking prescription waste. The thought behind Remedy Chain has been that, yes, we're going to get the stuff that can be recycled, the pristine, unopened, great stuff. But the stuff that has to be thrown away, we're going to get the data on it so that we can identify that. What that looks like, if you go to the Remedy Chain website, it doesn't say anything about chemo meds. The messaging is basically, for good health, everybody should empty out their medicine cabinet once a year. Everybody has boards, meds, there's tons of stuff in there. My kids have gotten into my medicine cabinet, you know. So when you do that once a year, let's say you got 10 drugs in there, 9 of them will probably need to be disposed to be amber vials, but let's say there's one in there that's good that can be donated. Well, we would have you take a picture of each med and send it to us. On the one good med, we'll send you a donation form and a link so you can send that in. On the other 9, we say, hey, here are drug disposal boxes in your neighborhood where you can take and properly dispose of that medicine instead of flushing it down the toilet. And then further, if they do that, if they text us a picture from the disposal unit, from anyone that we sent them, i.e. check in from the disposal unit, then we enter them for a $500 raffle. What we're doing is we're incentivizing people to empty the medicine cabinet, to properly dispose of the stuff that needs to be disposed of, to reclaim the stuff that can be recycled, and we're capturing the data on everything without having to get into the disposal business, because they take them to a recognized disposal. Like, we're not having, we're just capturing the data.
Do you ever find out if it was half they used, or if it was, like, let's say they put in a quantity of 90. Do you know that they used, or do you care that they used half of the prescription?
Not yet.
You don't care about the goals necessarily of compliancy so much. You're going to get a count of what was wasted.
Yes. So what we do is we get a picture of every pill. As you know, from a picture of the pill, you can go Google Pillbox and you can say it's a white round pill with an X on it. And what is it? So we can identify to the NDC level from a picture what the medicine was. And then we just take the patient's reported quantity, because it is, you know, if somebody wanted to argue that that's not accurate, then fine. What we're really proving is that, because it's never... it's rarely just one med. Again, it's the medicine cabinet. It's 8 or 9 different NDCs. The goal being, with that information, in Phil Baker's mind, in a perfect world, the way this would work would be a circular economy. So from a picture, I can say, okay, that's a Pfizer pill. I can collect all this data for a month and I can say, okay, Pfizer, in the city of Memphis this month, we recorded 15,000 pounds worth of your meds being disposed. Here's your bill for that. Counties have mandated, and it's kind of spreading, especially primarily in California right now, but counties can enforce that wholesalers and manufacturers have to fund the disposal of meds within their own county. So we're hopeful with Remedy Chain that if manufacturers would essentially buy back their waste data, then that would fund the platform that allows everybody to get donated meds for free. That would financially support the whole thing. By buying back their waste data, they can compare that with their production data like every other industry does, and determine if maybe they're producing too much or not enough. And like, by starting to track this waste data, there's going to be, I believe, just tons and tons of value that comes out of it. Manufacturing, ecosystem, you know, just all different kinds of things. So Remedy Chain is a database. It's a blockchain data lake of this waste data that people are sending us from all over the country. We standardize the data and we put it on a blockchain so that whenever we get to scale, whenever there's enough, we'll actually ultimately be able to use machine learning to predict waste. Let's make a prediction about where we think we might see waste now.
Tell me what you mean by token there. Is that the same? That's not like in Bitcoin where someone goes searches for these and gets like money because of their computer power and stuff. Is that the same thing with this?
They don't have to be mined. Are you familiar with CryptoKitties?
I just know about mining. I don't know about CryptoKitties.
So there's two kinds of tokens. There are fungible tokens, which means they can be spent. They're like money. And then there's non-fungible tokens, which are absolutely unique. They're one-of-a-kind creations, digital assets. And so there's two different whole categories of what you can do with those. CryptoKitties is ridiculous. I've never had to describe this to anybody. It's going to sound really stupid. But a CryptoKitty is a little a cartoon version of a kitty cat. And which is back to a blockchain record, but each one is unique. So it may have a green eye and a black eye and polka dots or whatever. What makes them valuable is that people value them. So there's like baseball cards, there's a market where these things go for $50,000, $150,000.
It's like searching for Pikachu or something like that.
Kind of like that, yeah. But you know with it, because it's on a blockchain, that you've got the only one. It's completely unique.
How specific do you think they're going to get with blockchain? Is it going to be down to a lot or down to a bottle?
We're already down to a bottle. Yeah, my system is down to a bottle. With the serialization of the meds, it's already, the number's already on the bottle.
You think they'll ever get down to a pill with like a little bit of a computer chip in every one of them?
We've made our system so that you can get down to a pill. So you can do the blockchain record and you can open a bottle and you can unit dose them. And if you wanted to, you could tag each individual pill. We built a system that does that. And that's too, like, that's, so that's part of Remedy Chain now is we bring the meds in. But what we want to build is basically at least one partner site per state, because recycled medicine laws are determined by the state board of pharmacy for that state, and they vary tremendously. Instead of like, what I can't do is build a mail order pharmacy that distributes these things over the country. It'd just be too difficult. But we can do like one per state, and we can shift between centers in each state, like that sort of structural work. So Remedy Chain is access to the meds, but it's also a blockchain inventory system that we would be giving these sites to maintain as well, so that we're all on the same database.
Because you already cut down this to once a quarter and you're saving money that way, you're already saving on, let's say, two trips a quarter. Now, when that trip actually happens, you were mentioning kind of the Uber-ish kind of thing. Were you? Tell me more about that.
Our patients pay a monthly membership fee. They get all their meds at cost. And they're mostly low income and uninsured. It occurred to me a couple of years ago, why don't we set up a program where our patients, you know, say you're paying $50 a month, you could do 5 deliveries a month. We'll give you $10 for each delivery, and you could pay down your membership fee by making deliveries. Also a neat use case potentially for a cryptocurrency or a token. So we built a platform to do that. And we built an app that integrated with Pioneer RX, does integrate with Pioneer RX, that allows us to take a pool of volunteer drivers and bring them in. So when we do our deliveries, because it's a batch fill, we do 250 deliveries in Memphis at one time. It does work, like, besides just for the batch, like for a regular pharmacy as well. So that was a side project that I was like, we're spending $2,000 on postage for these deliveries. If we can use volunteers, that's $2,000 per quarter back in the bank. And so we built that. It's called Script Ride, and it was meant to be a volunteer platform where you could volunteer to your favorite pharmacy to make deliveries, or you could any sort of rideshare delivery services. You could volunteer to St. Jude to pick up families at the airport and take them to the Ronald McDonald House. It was going to interact with nonprofits in this way. Then COVID happened, and all my pharmacy friends started calling me, and they were saying, Phil, I need you to teach me how to be a mail order pharmacy on my independence. And started looking at that and realized you don't need to be a mail order pharmacy. You need to be a delivery pharmacy, because if you're an independent and everybody lives in your neighborhood, you don't want to send it to the post office so that they can deliver it across the street 3 days later. And so this platform that we built, we scrapped using volunteers and we used shared ride drivers to make the deliveries. And that has become a whole new company now called Script Ride, where it's a customized delivery service designed for pharmacies. Pharmacy deliveries are not like other deliveries. There's very rarely an emergency where you need to get atorvastatin to a patient within 2 hours. You know what I mean? So, and if you get it, if you can get it there by 8 o'clock the same night, you're generally going to be 100% good to go. And if you can get it there next day, 80% of the time. So we've structured it so that there's a daily pickup, and then you can do stat deliveries as needed. But by getting enough pharmacies involved, we can support a driver locally, just to do those. And that's building out now. My share ride partner has drivers in 34 markets. And so we're about to expand it and try to grow it to other independents as well. What we do that's kind of different too is there's the application. We make it as simple as possible. And then our drivers, when we come in, we bring all the boxes you're going to need, because if you've never done delivery before, you don't know what kind of boxes to get, what's most efficient. You don't know what kind of coolers to get. And we brand everything with we don't put our branding on it. We put the pharmacies on it. And so when the box shows up at your patient's door, it says Smith Pharmacy. It doesn't say Script Ride. You can maintain your own brand throughout.
Instead of you saying, hey, I'm an Uber customer standing at the airport, I need a Lyft, is basically you're signing up your prescription and saying this needs to go somewhere and the drivers can choose it or pick it, or are they doing more group, bigger batch stuff?
We have made it both ways. So our platform, if one of our own drivers, because we want our drivers to be HIPAA certified, I don't think they're required to be, but we don't want some stranger off of Lyft. We have our own drivers that we depend on. However, we built the platform so that if our driver isn't available, it does go. There's an API with Lyft, and it does put a call out for a Lyft driver to pick it up.
When you talk about programs, so let's say now in the last few years, you've had to make, let's say half dozen programs or something. Do you have software people you like? Are you skilled at it yourself? I mean, how are you throwing these apps together? Who's doing this for you?
There haven't been very many apps. I have a software partner. I have a good friend who owns a software development company and has 30 full-time developers in Bucharest, Romania, which are some of the best in the world. But we haven't built very many apps. So the blockchain technology, it's just different. You don't build apps. There are dApps that you can build, but that's been largely it's so much in its infancy, but just determining the information standards and how we're going to do it. So I built our Remedy Chain team built out the MVP of Remedy Chain and what that looks like. But it didn't take a software development firm.
When I went online and looked at it and I saw that it had the pictures of what to do and you take a picture and do this, I forget if I was looking at an app or were they just taking a picture and texting it somewhere?
I don't consider it an app, but there is on our website, there's an app that shows our inventory in real time that we just created using a little SaaS software platform. It's a very, very simple little app. It's nothing you wouldn't go to the App Store and download the Remedy Chain app.
As the numbers got up there, you could do something more. But right now, you haven't spent a lot of time in apps yet.
That's exactly right. What I've learned in business in the last 5 years is I was always quick to try to build an app or build a system. And man, in this day and age, I'm not convinced anymore that you ever need to do that. We're able, and that's kind of the value we bring to the table too, with this membership model that I want other people to employ. If you want to start a membership pharmacy, how are you going to set up recurring billing? What CRM are you going to use? How are you going to be HIPAA compliant? So we figured all those things out. You use Stripe for your billing, you use G Suite to be HIPAA compliant with your email, all the different system. There's a HIPAA compliant text service that we use. The CRM is really key to how you work, which pharmacists are not familiar with. You know, it's not an operating system. It's not Pioneer. It is different.
Can I ask what CRM program it is?
It's Copper is the one that we use, which sits on top of G Suite. It used to be called ProsperWorks, and now it's called Copper. And that one's good because it works really well with everything we do is we're Google based for the most part. So we get really far on Google Sheets and little apps that read off Google. We've gotten way further than anybody. I built a Remedy Chain app legitimate to show the live inventory, scrapped it, and went back to just something that was easier that we could piece together using a couple different things.
Well, part of the problems with apps, even if you're not paying a lot for them, you can spend weeks waiting for a color change or, you know, a different font or something like that. In the meantime, you could have been cranking this stuff out with all of the, you know, the things you mentioned, all the different programs that are already out there, and you can always shine it up later. But, you know, a lot of times it's best to get some numbers, get some beef under it first, and then you'll probably know more of what you want anyways at that time.
Agree.
So let's say you have these quarters, all right? And if I talk to like a accountant, you know, they're going to say, oh, geez, April, you know, April 15th, that's a pain in the ass, or, you know, the first of the year or something like that. I'm sure in theory, it'd be great to level this stuff out so you feel about the same amount of joy and stress throughout the year. With your quarterly stuff, is there a ramp up of energy or of stress, or is that pretty level, or like as you get closer or further away from something, like things seem to lighten up throughout these four quarters?
We've been doing group synchronization since September of 2017. So we've done 3 years, 4, 8, 12, probably 13 or 14 batch refills now. I say that to say that when you do group synchronization and you live within this 12-week recurring cycle, you are able to systematize everything. So we have figured out that in week 10 is when you want to send refill requests, because if you send them too early, the physician's going to deny it and say, I just wrote refills last month. You want to wait. All these different processes on how we request different things, how we do that. We review every single profile before we really kick it off, before we press enter, so that when we press enter, everything moves from the refill queue into the, you know, the fill queue with as few exceptions as possible.
My listeners know that I'm like a 3 or 4 time failure of syncing, but the group sync sounds pretty interesting. Do you see retail pharmacy being able to do that as far as group syncing every quarter versus like just having patients that are synced, but not to any real schedule?
The question is, will PBMs pay for it when they are directly incentivized not to? So if you make a dispensing fee on every 30-day fill, there's not a directly, you know, incentivization to want to do that. I have crossed paths with PBMs in the marketplace, and they'll say, we have 90-day fills. And or we have, you know, we do MedSync and we have 90-day fills. It's the same thing, but it's not the same thing, because if you get a 90-day fill and then you get a new med tomorrow, the whole sync is off. You know, one incident, and even group sync, as I said before, you're still looking at 2.9 visits every 90 days. There's still quite a few changes. The thing that makes it work is we are not billing claims. And then also we get our money up front. So the cash model is completely different too. Once they're synced up, we can say to the employer, okay, Mr. Employer, you have 100 employees. Their meds are going to cost $100,000 at our cost. We're going to charge you $20,000 to do fulfillment. So give us $120,000 up front. Now we'll go buy the drugs and now we'll do fulfillment. So I don't have to wait 6 months to get, you know, there's no inventory sitting on the shelf. There's no reimbursement lag. We're cash flow positive on the front end, which allows us to get pre-purchase discounts, which your folks will know are the best you can get, you know, the best discounts you're ever going to get at pre-purchase, and drive prices down further, further, further.
How old are you now?
I'm 40. I'm about to turn 45 in 2 weeks. I'll turn 45.
45. So do you see yourself at 55? Will you still be part of Good Shepherd, or will you be way off doing something else because this is running fine and there's other ideas for you to do?
I don't think I've talked much about Halo Scripts, which is the for-profit business we started.
Tell us about that.
Group synchronization being our secret sauce, after we'd been doing it for a couple of years here, we started working with a local employer, and he said, how can you save me, you know, my company money? And we essentially did the same thing. We said, we can take all your employees, we can synchronize all their prescriptions, give you one bill every 90 days at cost, reducing all the markup. And it ends up reducing the total spend by like 40%. It's very significant. And we make great, great money at the same time. So, We've been servicing that account now for 2.5 years, but it was very much the guinea pig. I got the data, I got 2 years worth of data, and I costed everything out at my price and started crunching it and just crunched it and crunched it and crunched it and tried to figure out how do we make this work. Well, we figured out how to make it work, and we last year started a separate pharmacy called Halo Scripts to contract directly. It's a for-profit pharmacy that contracts directly with employers. All drugs sold at cost. We charge a per member fee on the, you know, for the group. And we charge a percentage of savings actually to determine what the fee is. So there's only savings involved.
Give me an example of that.
So I sync up all the generics and I say, okay, 94% of these were on 90-day fills and we switched them down to 90. So we saved you X in transaction fees and dispensing fees. You had AWP pricing on these drugs that we're now going to sell you at cost. So you spent $10,000 and we're only going to charge you $250. And so the total savings is X.
Against what a PBM would.
Against what they've been paying on their PBM. So we have the data from their PBM to know exactly what they've been paying.
Whether it's been mail order or through a pharmacy or something, that's what they've been paying.
Yep, that's what the company has been paying. And so that's key to the whole thing is we have the data from the company to state. We do not come in and say, we're your new PBM, we're your new pharmacy solution. We say, we're going to make the PBM work more efficiently. We're going to synchronize all the chronic meds and do just that. So how we determine what we're going to charge is we add up dispensing fees, administrative fees, plus all the markup. And then we charge a percentage of that savings that we're saving the company. And it's different for brands and generics and specialty. It ranges from 50 to 25% savings for different things. So that when we come on board, it's not you have to make a big investment. It's like we're going to charge you a percentage of savings. You're going to start saving on day one.
Yeah, they can't lose if they're paying only off their savings. If you can't save them anything, then they're not paying anything, in theory.
It's a win-win for both of us. So there are patients where we save $2,500 every 90 days, and then there are others where we save $2 every 90 days. But by doing the 50%, you know, the savings share, we can service the entire group. When we started, we were just doing the top 10% of the group, the biggest utilizers, the biggest savings, and the employers want us to do the whole group. They love our service. They really want us to be the company's pharmacy, so to speak. That's Halo Scripts. We started that company in March of 2020, March of last year. We got $500,000 investment to license it nationally and scale it up. We just completed, it hasn't even been entirely our full year, but we our first big company was an Accenture subsidiary out of Baltimore that we've been servicing since last March. And we're about to get 10 customers that size this year that we've queued up. So things are going really, really well on that front. And again, it's 100% price transparency. We're not marking anything up. We're being honest about what the drugs cost, and it's fee for service. Where I want to land with group synchronization is I'm really hopeful that we can create a new quote unquote clinical metric so that we can say to the employer, if we hit 80% synchronization, we're going to charge you X. But if we hit 95% synchronization, we're going to charge you Y, because we know the more synchronized they are, the more savings there is involved. I'm working with the University of Tennessee and have been for 2 years to study this model to kind of tease it out to just that. It basically boils down to there's three kinds of meds: generics, brands, and specialties. The biggest markup is on the generics, and so you get savings from markup on generics. Brand name drugs, they're more expensive, but they're not horribly marked up. If you're lucky, there's generally about a 10% savings between cost and retail. When you look at brands, which for my employers is not terribly significant. It's not nothing, but generics is where the real markup is. So when it comes to brands, you got at cost, like I said, 10%. You got Canada, which is 50% savings. And then you've got assistance programs. And we're familiar with every assistance program in the country. When you get to specialty, you've got at cost, which is nothing, because if it's $1 million med, it's $1 million at cost. You know, there's not a ton of markup. You've got assistance programs, and then you've got clinical trials. And you can look at international clinical trials. You can look at international pharmacy. But whatever the category of drug it is, you've got a fixed number of options that'll work for you, and that's it. And we've worked that out. That's my soapbox. So, that's how it plays out. We're partnered with Diamond Pharmacy with Halo Scripts, and they are one of the biggest independently owned pharmacy networks in the country. Also one of the oldest, over 103 years old. They do 80% of the correctional facilities in the country. And so they are nationally licensed out of Pennsylvania. They're doing fulfillment for us. And big pharmacy, they purchase over $300 million a year in drugs. And they're giving us their pricing, their at-cost pricing, and passing that on to the employers. So we're getting like hospital-level pricing and passing it on to the employers.
If one of those companies came and they said, hey, Bob's on $1 million drug, you're like, all right, you'll pay us $1 million and then we'll get it for you. It's not like you're taking a loss or you're the insurance company or something.
It's never happened where they said, well, that specialty drug, we'll just buy it from you at cost, because the savings has never been significant enough. And there's not much help to be had on specialty meds, let me say. So, but your one hope is a trial or an assistance program. When we get a patient into an assistance program, it's 100% savings, and we get a percentage of savings. So those specialty med assistance programs are really valuable.
And if something is expensive, if you don't want to do it, they'll get it still from their PBM or something?
They can always get it from the PBM.
And you'd almost rather.
Yeah, we don't make anything on the med, so the value of the med is independent of what we make. We don't do any controlled substances. We have a really good extensive onboarding process where we set expectations. We tell people we're mail order. If you need something right away, we're probably not going to be the best option. You still have your insurance. You still have your insurance card. You can go to Walgreens. Nothing has changed. If you need a narcotic or an antibiotic, go to Walgreens and get it right away. But if it's a chronic med, let us know. And the value proposition is for the employees, if you get it through us, there's no copays. So zero copays. Show up on a set schedule that we're telling you now, all your meds kept on the same schedule.
Going back to that question of where you might be in 10 years, if I were to have asked you this 2 years ago, do you think that it was always going to be in your blood to get back to a for-profit thing? Is it fun to play in the arena of nonprofit? Fun to say, yes, I can do well with nonprofit, and it's a good calling, and it's rewarding and stuff, but I have something to prove that I want to get out in the for-profit market, and I want to show some cool things I can do in the for-profit stuff besides nonprofit. Is that in you?
That it is a little bit of competitiveness in me, in that in Phil Baker's brain, the goal has always been financial self-sustainability. So even though we're a nonprofit, the goal has always been to live and die, to not be beholden to donations, to not be dependent on grants. And so there's, in one sense, we've been successful in that we've gotten donations and grants from the nonprofit sense. We've been good at fundraising. We've won grants. We've stayed alive. But we haven't achieved the goal of financial self-sustainability on the nonprofit side. And so that's still ongoing. I know we can. I know how to get there. On the for-profit side, it's really, and for both, it's always been about a new model of pharmacy. I've always wanted to create, never want to create a big mega mail order pharmacy, big company. I want to invent a different model of community pharmacy that says, you know what? Two pharmacists, four technicians, a Script Pro robot can serve 5,000 patients that are group synchronized. They can make more than enough money so that everybody has a comfortable living and doesn't work themselves sick. And this is how you do it. You do low-income people for a subscription fee. You do businesses for a different, and you piece it together. You're operationally, whether they're business people or low-income people, their prescriptions are on the same schedule. So everything is synchronized. We're not beholden to claims. And so the goal has always been to figure out this new model of pharmacy and what that looks like. The goal on the for-profit side was to be successful and to show explosive growth on that, and to get enough money to do the nonprofit work for the rest of my life.
As 20 years go by and you're at the end of all this and you look back and all this stuff has happened, what will you be saying? This is good. This is cool. This is proof of my goal. How would you describe all this if it goes the way you want it? What's that feeling going to be?
Oh, man. The only thing that comes to mind is, look at what God did. That's what I say to myself now. Like I said before, I didn't have this big mastermind plan for this. I was going to open a charity pharmacy and give meds away for free, and that's all, and do MTM. And now we've got a blockchain company. We've got a prescription delivery service. We're serving all these people who wouldn't get their meds any other way. And none of it has anything to do with me. Everything that really moved the needle had absolutely nothing to do with me. It fell into my lap and just had nothing to do with me.
If you don't want to think it has anything to do with you, throw the keys up as high as you can. Tell God to hold on to him and run things for a few months. You'll come back in the fall. Let's see how it's going. All right, Phil, pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, man, it was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.